Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. In the past week alone, the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy's Sharktivity app has logged at least 38 great white shark sightings in Massachusetts waters, most of them right off the coast of Cape Cod, sometimes yards from the beach.
Shark sightings have beachgoers on high alert.
Right now, the water is the perfect temperature for sharks, and already today, folks have spotted nearly a dozen.
Partly cloudy with a chance of sharks.
Some sounds there from TV news coverage in the past couple of weeks. Our next guest argues that we misunderstand sharks, that they're not the terrifying man-eating killers of Jaws fame, but essential parts of our fragile ocean ecosystem, and they need our protection. William McKeever is a conservationist and author. His new book is Emperors of the Deep, Sharks, the Ocean's Most Mysterious, Most Misunderstood, and Most Important Guardians. And he joins us now from NPR in New York. William McKeever, welcome to Radio Boston.
Tiziana, thank you for having me on.
It's a pleasure. And I want to start with what we just heard, which was some local and national media reports about shark sightings down on Cape Cod. Just this afternoon, officials closed Nauset Beach in Orleans for about an hour after a shark was sighted there. What do you think we are misunderstanding about the danger of sharks?
I think that what has happened in this country is that ever since Jaws came out, there's been this perception that sharks are man-eaters, and that if they come across a human being, they're going to take advantage of that and attack. The reality is very different. Sharks have been around for 450 million years, and they're programmed to eat fish and seals and sea lions and not people. So when they do come across a person, they typically swim away. Now, there are times when sharks make mistakes and there are bites, and sometimes something untoward happens, but these are very, very rare events. Sharks are in the surf constantly, and considering our thousands of miles of coastline, it's remarkable that they're only 50 to 55 bites a year. That just shows you that they're not interested.
I hear you, and I do understand what you're saying. I find myself thinking at the same time, you know, there was a death of a 26-year-old, Arthur Medici, last summer on Cape Cod. I know that was a mistake, but that is a costly, costly mistake from a shark. Shouldn't that put healthy fear into people about this apex predator?
Well, I think if we need to put it into perspective, Tiziana, and that is that whenever you go into the ocean, you're entering a wilderness area, much in the way as if you were going into Yellowstone Park in the backwoods. You don't know what you're going to encounter. And when you indeed go in that area, I think you have to be respectful of sharks. They are apex predators. They're at the top of the pyramid. So you don't want to have an interaction with them. And I think that's the takeaway message here. It's not that we should be afraid. The fact is there are 3 million surfers in this country. And this is the time of the year when they're out enjoying the ocean. And there are plenty of YouTube videos of showing sharks actually swimming amongst the surfers. And I think it's a tragedy for people to waste the psychic energy. Now, I think if you see a shark in the water, obviously it's best to leave until they swim away. So you want to, again, be respectful. But in terms of bringing this fear, I think that's misplaced.
You know, when I was reading your book, Emperors of the Deep, one of the things that you reframed in my head for me in reading the book is I always think of sharks as being biters. But after reading the book, what I found myself thinking of is they're mouthers, like a baby to encounter something puts everything in its mouth, right? Because that's how it encounters what's new. And my sense from your book was that often that's what sharks are doing. It's how they touch or check things out. Am I understanding that correctly?
That's a very good point, Tiziana. And in fact, you'll see many times on YouTube, underwater camera operators, you know, when that underwater camera is actually sending out electrical signal, that attracts a shark's attention.
Do they read electrical signals?
Yes. Every animal, every creature in the ocean sends off an electric field. And the sharks have evolved over this time to be able to sense it. And so as an example, so you're an underwater photographer, you've got a tiger shark in front of you. That tiger shark is looking at the camera. and may take a bite just to see what it is. It's similar to our hands. You know, we'd like to touch and feel. Mm-hmm. For shark, it's a little nip. And so that's how they get information. So I think your point is well taken.
You went out, you know, if you will, kind of to use your hands to touch and feel sharks yourself. But before you went into the water, you went to a shark hunting tournament. What was that like?
That was just one of the saddest events I've ever been to in my life.
Why?
So here I am walking in Montauk, and I always love the ocean and et cetera. And so I'm walking along, and I see all of these sharks, makos, tiger sharks, thresher sharks. They're hanging from yardarms as if they were common criminals who had to be executed for some crime. And it made me so sad because here are these beautiful animals. They've done nothing wrong. So it got me going to find out, well, what's the real story here? Maybe they do deserve this kind of treatment. So I ended up going 2.5 years around the world talking to scientists and diving with sharks to find out what the truth was. And I was shocked at what I learned. And I learned so much. And I put it into this book, Emperors of the Deep, The Shark, to tell people that the views of sharks are just these myths that have been created over decades, and we need to revisit them. And so I look back now on that shark tournament, and it energized me to do everything I can to stop the tournaments, but more importantly, to think about ways we can save sharks around the world, because they are being massacred. 100 million sharks are being killed every year. Sharks are experiencing the greatest threat to their existence in a 450 million year history. And that's something that I think is a great tragedy and makes me sad.
You know, that those numbers are especially, you know, anxiety inducing when one reads, as one does in your book, about the important role of sharks in balancing an ocean ecosystem. That's not how I'm used to thinking of an apex predator. Wow, there's this fragile ecosystem, something's got to keep it in balance, and it's an apex predator who does that. But you write that that actually is a really important role that the shark plays.
Yes, it is. And, you know, the old view is that, well, apex predators kill. This actually should be flipped on its head. Apex predators give life. They keep systems in balance. The best example, just to very quickly, maybe easy to grasp the concept, is that you may remember in Yellowstone, they took the wolves out thinking that, well, we'll yeah. have all these deer we can hunt. And it was an ecological disaster. The rivers actually started to meander more, and several species of animals, beaver, lynx, started to suffer. And they, rightly so, brought the wolves back. And it had a dramatic transformation on Yellowstone. The rivers flowed straighter again, and the beaver came back, and it was dramatic. And so we go now into the ocean. The same concept applies to Tiziana. The apex predator in the ocean is the shark. And when that shark comes into the ocean, it prevents any one species of fish from monopolizing resources, whether it's on a reef or in a seagrass system. So by keeping that balance, we keep the oceans healthy. There are plenty of fish that we can eat and provides jobs. And I could go through, I spent hours with you on this because it's fascinating, about in every ecosystem, sharks are doing something very important, whether it's seagrass systems or reefs or open water systems. The sharks are there, and they are a keystone species in the ocean that we need.
Yeah, I haven't really thought of them before as sort of Jedis who keep balance in the force of the ocean. It's a really different way to think about them. And I want to, there's one other subject I want to make sure that we get to with you, because you talk in your book about the tensions between sharks in the commercial fishing industry. You call out the tuna industry, but that's not the only industry you call out. As you, I'm sure, know, fishing industry is quite important here in the Commonwealth. Is there a way to have commercial fishing and have sharks thrive?
Yes, there is. And that's a great question, because I think there's this view that, well, if sharks cost jobs or they reduce income, then that's just the price they have to pay. The reality is that we can construct a regulatory system that allows sharks to survive and allows fish to be caught sustainably so that we can continue to fish for tuna or whatever it is for the indefinite future. And the current regulations that we have are just antiquated. They should be thrown out. Now, I'll be the first to say, in the United States, we do a pretty good job of managing our fish populations. But when you get outside of the United States and you go on the high seas in the Pacific Ocean, it is the wild, wild west out there. These fishing boats are sending lines that are 100, 150 miles long. They're catching seabirds and turtles and all kinds of bycatch and killing them by the hundreds of thousands. And that's where sharks are getting massacred, because those fishing vessels, which are manned by slaves, surprisingly, they're finning those sharks to get the fin to sell them so they can get some money in, because they're not being paid a living wage. So you get this massacre of sharks. You get overfishing in the areas like the Pacific Ocean, and it's detrimental to all mankind. And my book makes a point that if we step back and put in the right kinds of regulations, this does not have to happen. We can make a difference.
So in our last minute or so, if you could pick one change to shark policy, either domestically or globally, if you could pick one, what would it be?
I would do this. I would create more marine protected areas. And what I mean by an MPA or marine protected area is where you set aside an area of the ocean where there's no commercial fishing at all. And all the fish in there get a chance to breed, grow up, expand, go elsewhere. This is where we create the ability of fish populations to recover from commercial fishermen. The United Nations has called for 20% of the oceans to be in MPAs by, I believe it's 2020. The scary thing is that today, only 3% of the oceans are in marine protected areas. So if we were to, and Greenpeace has called out for this, and I agree with them, we should put 30% of the oceans in marine protected areas by 2030. That can save sharks, save tuna, and the commercial fishing industry around the world.
Okay, in 10 seconds or so, what would your message be to our Cape Cod listeners or folks who are headed out into the water today or this weekend?
I would say enjoy the beach. You've worked hard. You deserve this vacation. The ocean is a wonder. And just be respectful. Be careful. Don't swim at night. Sharks are nocturnal. Swim within the break line and keep an eye out, and you'll be fine. And just enjoy it. So take advantage of that great ocean, the Cape, and that the islands offer people who live in Boston.
William McKeever is a conservationist and founder of Safeguard the Seas. His new book is Emperors of the Deep, Sharks, the Ocean's Most Mysterious, Most Misunderstood, and Most Important Guardians. He'll also be releasing a documentary film based on his travels next summer. William McKeever, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tiziana, for having me here. It's been a pleasure.
Finally today, we want to take time to remember the 22 people who were shot and killed in El Paso, Texas on Saturday. On Monday, we brought you the names of those shot and killed in a Dayton, Ohio mass shooting. And since then, officials in El Paso, Texas have released the names from that terrible massacre. 13 Americans, 8 Mexicans, and 1 German.
Jordan Anchondo, 24 years old, and her husband, Andre Anchondo, 23, were shopping for school supplies at the Walmart. Andre jumped in front of the gunman, and Jordan died shielding their newborn son. The son survived.
Arturo Benavides, 60, was at the self-checkout counter. An Army veteran and city bus driver, he usually went to Walmart after church on Sundays with his wife, Patty, but they switched their routine. Patty survived.
Maribel Hernandez, 56, and her husband, Leonard Campos, 41, had just dropped their dog off at the groomer and went shopping.
Raul and Maria Flores, both 77, had retired in El Paso 20 years ago from Southern California. Married for 60 years, they went to Walmart to buy air mattresses for visiting relatives.
Jorge Cavillo Garcia was visiting his son and granddaughter in El Paso from Torreon, Mexico. Emily, his granddaughter, was raising money for her soccer team outside the store, and he shielded her from the bullets. He was 61 years old.
Adolfo Cerros Hernandez, 68, and Sarah Esther Regalado, 66, were a couple from Mexico. A granddaughter posted on Facebook, I don't know if there is a heaven or not, but if there is, I hope you're as comfortable and happy as you were here.
Alexander Gerhard Hoffmann was a German citizen. The German embassy wouldn't provide NPR with any other details to protect his privacy. He was 66 years old.
David Johnson died protecting his wife Kathy and their 9-year-old daughter Katie. They both survived. He was 63.
Luis Alfonso Juarez was 90 years old. He was shopping for groceries with his wife. She was injured and has been released from the hospital. His family described him as an amazing human being, loving, calm, and big-hearted. He was the oldest victim in El Paso.
Maria Eugenia Legareta Roth, 58, was a businesswoman from the Mexican state of Chihuahua. She was in El Paso to pick up her daughter, Natalie, from the airport, but stopped at Walmart first. She never made it to the terminal.
Elsa Libera Marquez taught special education in Ciudad Juarez, Mexico. She regularly visited family in El Paso and had stopped at Walmart. Her husband and son were waiting in the car. She was 57.
Iván Ildierto Manzano, 46, worked in marketing and sales in Ciudad Juarez, Mexico. An avid marathoner, he leaves behind 2 young children.
Gloria Irma Marquez was a school teacher from Ciudad Juarez, Mexico. A mother of 4, her niece remembers her as a cheerful person with a big smile. She was 61.
Margie Record, 63, had always planned to live together and die together with her husband of more than 20 years, Antonio Brasco. He's now a widower.
Javier Rodriguez, 15, went by Amir. He loved playing soccer with the Express Football Club and was a good student. He was the youngest victim in El Paso.
Teresa Sanchez de Freitas was visiting from Mexico. She was 82 years old.
Angelina Inglesby, 86, went by Angie. Widowed early in her life, she raised 7 children alone, a grandmother of 20, a devout Catholic, and a lover of golf, football, and basketball. Her family says she always had a meal and a pot of fresh coffee for anyone who visited her home.
Juan Velasquez, 77, died shielding his wife, Estela, from the gunman. They both had moved to El Paso 6 months ago and had received U.S. citizenship. Estela was injured, but she survived.
That's Radio Boston for today. Thank you for listening. I'm Tiziana Deering.